merged in the carpet's fibers. Each of the frame's side had a narrow steel shelf welded at 90 degrees to its interior's base, so that a single rectangular narrow shelf perpendicular to the frame's rectangle ran all around the frame's interior. This shelf was obviously there to support the bed's occupants and king-size box spring and mattress. My father seemed frozen in place. I cannot remember what my mother was doing. There seemed to be a long silent interval of my father looking closely at the exposed frame. The interval had the silence and stillness of dusty rooms immersed in sunlight. I briefly imagined every piece of furniture in the bedroom covered with sheets, and the room unoccupied for years as the sun rose and crossed and fell outside the window, the room's daylight becoming staler and staler. I could hear two power lawnmowers of slightly different pitch from somewhere down our subdivision street. The direct light through the master bedroom's window swam with rotating columns of raised dust. I remember it seemed the ideal moment for a sneeze. Dust lay thick on the frame and even hung from the frame's interior support shelf in little gray beards. It was impossible to see any bolts anywhere on the frame. My father blotted sweat and wet makeup from his forehead with the back of his sleeve, which was now dark orange with makeup.
"Jesus, will you look at that mess," he said.
He looked at my mother.
"Jesus!"
The carpeting in my parents' bedroom was deep pile, and a darker blue than the pale blue of the rest of the bedroom's color scheme. I remember the carpet as more a royal blue, with a saturation level somewhere between moderate and strong. The rectangular expanse of royal blue carpet that had been hidden under the bed was itself carpeted with a thick layer of clotted dust. The rectangle of dust was gray-white and thick and unevenly layered, and the only evidence of the room's carpet below was a faint, sick, bluish cast to the dust layer. It looked as if the dust had not drifted under the bed and settled on the carpet inside the frame, but rather had somehow taken root and grown on it, upon it, the way a mold would take root and gradually cover an expanse of spoiled food. The layer of dust itself looked a little like spoiled food, bad cottage cheese. It was nauseous. Some of the dust layer's uneven topography was caused by certain lost and litter-type objects that had found their way under the bed. A fly swatter, a roughly variety-sized magazine, some bottle tops, three wadded Kleenex, and what was probably a sock, and gotten covered and textured in dust. There was also a faint odor, sour and fungal, like the smell of an overused bath mat.
"Jesus, there's even a smell," my father said.
He made a show of inhaling through his nose and screwing up his face.
"There's even a fucking smell."
He blotted his forehead and felt his jaw and looked hard at my mother. His mood was no longer elevated. My father's mood surrounded him like a field and affected any room he occupied, like an odor or a certain cast to the light.
"When was the last time this got cleaned under here?"
my father asked my mother. My mother didn't say anything. She looked at my father as he moved the steel frame around a little with his boot, which raised even more dust into the window sunlight. The bed frame seemed very lightweight, moving back and forth, noiselessly on its casters, submerged wheels. My father often moved lightweight objects absently around with his foot, rather the way other men doodle or examine their cuticles. Rugs, magazines, telephone and electrical cords, his own removed shoe. It was one of my father's ways of musing or gathering his thoughts or trying to control his mood.
"Under what presidential administration was this room last deep cleaned? I'm standing here, prompted to fucking muse out loud,"
my father said. I looked at my mother to see whether she was going to say anything in reply. I said to my father, You know, since we're discussing squeaking beds, my bed squeaks too.
My father was trying to squat down to see whether he could locate any bolts on the frame, saying something to himself under his breath. He put his hands on the frame for balance and almost fell forward when the frame rolled under his weight.
But I don't think I even really noticed it until we began to discuss it, I said.
I looked at my mother.
I don't think it bothers me, I said. Actually, I think I kind of like it. I think I've gradually gotten so used to it that it's become almost comforting at this juncture, I said.
My mother looked at me.
I'm not complaining about it, I said. The discussion just made me think of it.
Oh, we hear your bed, don't you worry, my father said. He was still trying to squat, which drew his corset and the hem of his tunic up and allowed the top of his bottom's crack to appear above the waist of his white pants. He shifted slightly to point up at the master bedroom ceiling.
You so much as turn over and bed up there? We hear it down here.
He took one steel side of the rectangle and shook the frame vigorously, sending up a shroud of dust. The bed frame seemed to weigh next to nothing under his hands. My mother made a mustache of her finger to hold back a sneeze. He shook the frame again.
But it doesn't aggravate us the way this rodential son of a whore right here does.
I remarked that I didn't think I'd ever once heard their bed squeak before, from upstairs. My father twisted his head around to try to look up at me as I stood there behind him. But, I said, I definitely heard and could confirm the presence of a squeak when he'd pressed on the mattress, and could verify that the squeak was no one's imagination. My father held a hand up to signal me to please stop talking. He remained in a squat, rocking slightly on the balls of his feet, using the rolling frame to keep his balance. The flesh of the top of his bottom and crack area protruded over the waist of his pants. There were also deep red folds in the back of his neck, below the blunt cut of the wig, because he was looking up and over at my mother, who was resting her tailbone on the sill of the window, still holding her shallow ashtray.
"Maybe you'd like to go get the vacuum," he said.
My mother put the ashtray down on the sill and exited the master bedroom, passing between me and the dresser piled with bedding.
If you can remember where it is,
my father called after her. I could hear my mother trying to get past the king-size mattress, sagging diagonally across the hall. My father was rocking more violently on the balls of his feet, and now the rocking had the sort of rolling side-to-side quality of a ship in high seas. He came very close to losing his balance as he leaned to his right to get a handkerchief from his hip pocket, and began using it to reach out and flick dust off something at one corner of the bed frame. After a moment, he pointed down next to a caster.
"Bolt,"
he said, pointing at the side of a caster.
"Right there's a bolt."
I leaned in over him. Drops of my father's perspiration made small dark coins in the dust of the frame. There was nothing but smooth, lightweight, black steel surface where he was pointing. But just to the left of where he was pointing, I could see what might have been a bolt. A little stalactite of clotted dust hanging from some slight protrusion. My father's hands were broad and his fingers blunt. Another possible bolt lay several inches to the right of where he pointed. His fingers trembled badly, and I believe the trembling might have been from the muscular strain on his bad knees, trying to hold so much new weight in a squat for an extended period. I heard the telephone ring twice. There had been an extended silence, with my father pointing at neither protrusion, and me trying to lean in over him. Then, still squatting on the balls of his feet, my father placed both hands on the side of the frame, and leaned out over the side into the rectangle of dust inside the frame, and had what, at first, sounded like a bad coughing fit. His hunched back and rising bottom kept me from watching him. I remember deciding that the reason the frame was not rolling under his hand's pressure was that my father had so much of his weight on it, and that maybe my father's nervous system's response to heavy dust was a cough signal instead of a sneeze signal.
It was the wet sound of material hitting the dust inside the rectangle, plus the rising odor that signified to me that, rather than coughing, my father had been taken ill. The spasms involved made his back rise and fall and his bottom tremble under his white commercial slacks. It was not too uncommon for my father to be taken ill shortly after coming home from work to relax, but now he seemed to have been taken really ill. To give him some privacy, I went around the frame to the side of the frame closest to the window, where there was direct light and less odor, and examined another of the frame's casters. My father was whispering to himself in brief, expletive phrases between the spasms of his illness. I squatted easily and rubbed dust from a small area of the frame and wiped the dust on the carpet by my feet. There was a small carriage head bolt on either side of the plating that attached the caster to the bed frame. I knelt and felt one of the bolts. Its round, smooth head made it impossible either to tighten or loosen. Putting my cheek to the carpet and examining the bottom of the little horizontal shelf welded to the frame's side, I observed that the bolt seemed threaded tightly and completely through its hole, and I decided it was doubtful that any of the casters, platings, bolts, were producing the sounds that reminded my father of rodents. Just at this time, I remember, there was a loud cracking sound, and my area of the frame jumped violently as my father's illness caused him to faint and he lost his balance and pitched forward and lay prone and asleep over his side of the bed frame, which, as I rolled away from the frame and rose to my knees, I saw was either broken or very badly bent. My father lay face down in the mixture of the rectangle's thick dust and the material he'd brought up from his upset stomach. The dust his collapse raised was very thick, and as the new dust rose and spread, it attenuated the master bedroom's daylight as decisively as if a cloud had moved over the sun in the window. My father's professional wig had detached and lay scalp up in the mixture of dust and stomach material. The stomach material appeared to be mostly gastric blood until I recalled the tomato juice my father had been drinking. He lay face down, with his bottom high in the air, over the side of the bed frame, which his weight had broken in half. This was how I accounted for the loud cracking sound. I stood out of the way of the dust and the window's dusty light, feeling along the line of my jaw and examining my prone father from a distance. I remember that his breathing was regular and wet, and that the dust mixture bubbled somewhat. It was then that it occurred to me that when I'd been supporting the bed's raised mattress with my chest and face, preparatory to its removal from the room, the dihedral triangle I'd imagined the mattress forming with the box spring in my body had not in fact even been a closed figure. The box spring and the floor I had stood on did not constitute a continuous plane. Then I could hear my mother trying to get the heavy canister vacuum cleaner past the angled Simmons beauty rest in the hall, and I went to help her. My father's legs were stretched out across the clean blue carpet between his side of the frame and my mother's white dresser. His feet's boots were at a pigeon-toed angle, and his bottom's crack all the way down to the anus itself was now visible because the force of his fall had pulled his white slacks down even farther. I stepped carefully between his legs. "Excuse me," I said. I was able to help my mother by telling her to detach the vacuum cleaner's attachments and hand them one at a time to me over the width of the slumped mattress where I held them. The vacuum cleaner was manufactured by Regina, and its canister, which contained the engine, bag, and evacuating fan, was very heavy. I reassembled the vacuum and held it while my mother made her way back across the mattress, then handed the vacuum cleaner back to her, flattening myself against the wall to let her pass by on her way into the master bedroom. "Thanks," my mother said as she passed. I stood there by the slumped mattress for several moments of a silence so complete that I could hear the street's lawnmowers all the way out in the hall. Then heard the sound of my mother pulling out the vacuum cleaner's retractable cord and plugging it into the same bedside outlet the steel reading lamps were attached to. I made my way over the angled mattress and quickly down the hall, made a sharp right at the entrance to the kitchen, crossed the foyer to the staircase, and ran up to my room, taking several stairs at a time, hurrying to get some distance between myself and the vacuum cleaner, because the sound of vacuuming has always frightened me in the same irrational way it seemed a bed's squeak frightened my father. I ran upstairs and pivoted left at the upstairs landing and went into my room. In my room was my bed. It was narrow, a twin bed, with a headboard of wood and frame and slats of wood. I didn't know where it had come from originally. The frame held a narrow box spring and mattress much higher off the floor than my parents' bed. It was an old-fashioned bed, so high off the floor that you had to put one knee up on the mattress and clamber up into it, or else jump. That is what I did. For the first time since I had become taller than my parents, I took several running strides in from the doorway, past my shelves' collection of prisms and lenses and tennis trophies, and my scale model magneto, past my bookcase, the walls' still posters from Powell's Peeping Tom, and the closet door and my bedside's high-intensity standing lamp, and jumped, doing a full swan dive, up onto my bed. I landed with my weight on my chest, with my arms and legs out from my body on the indigo comforter on my bed, squashing my tie and bending my glasses' temples slightly. I was trying to make my bed produce a loud squeak, which, in the case of my bed, I knew was caused by any lateral friction between the wooden slats and the frame's interior's shelf-like slat support. But in the course of the leap and the dive, my overlong arm hit the heavy iron pole of the high-intensity standing lamp that stood next to the bed. The lamp teetered violently and began to fall over sideways away from the bed. It fell with a kind of majestic slowness, resembling a felled tree. As the lamp fell, its heavy iron pole struck the brass knob on the door to my closet, shearing the knob off completely. The round knob and half its interior hex bolt fell off and hit my room's wooden floor with a loud noise and began then to roll around in a remarkable way, the sheared end of the hex bolt stationary and the round knob rolling on its circumference, circling it in a spherical orbit, describing two perfectly circular motions on two distinct axes, a non-Euclidean figure on a planar surface, i.e., a cycloid on a sphere. The closest conventional analog I could derive for this figure was a cycloid, L'Hôpital solution to Bernoulli's famous brachistochrone problem, the curve traced by a fixed point on the circumference of a circle rolling along a continuous plane. But since here, on the bedroom's floor, a circle was rolling around what was itself the circumference of a circle, the cycloid's standard parametric equations were no longer apposite. Those equations' trigonometric expressions here becoming themselves first-order differential equations. Because of the lack of resistance or friction against the bare floor, the knob rolled this way for a long time. As I watched over the edge of the comforter and mattress, holding my glasses in place, completely distracted from the minor D shriek of the vacuum below, it occurred to me that the movement of the amputated knob perfectly schematized what it would look like for someone to try to turn somersaults with one hand nailed to the floor. This was how I first became interested in the possibilities of annulation. The night after the chilly and sort of awkward joint Interdependence Day picnic for Enfield's Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, Somerville's Phoenix House, and Dorchester's grim New Choice Juvenile Rehab, Ennett House staffer Jeanette Foltz took Ken Erdetti and Kate Gompert along with her to this one NA beginners discussion meeting, where the focus was always marijuana. How every addict at the meeting had gotten in terrible addictive trouble with it right from the first Dubois, or else how they'd been strung out on harder drugs and had tried switching to grass to get off the original drugs, but then had gotten in even terribler trouble with grass than they'd been in with the original hard stuff. This was supposedly the only NA meeting in Metro Boston explicitly devoted to marijuana. Jeanette Foltz said she wanted Erdetti and Gompert to see how completely non-unique and un-alone they were in terms of the substance that had brought them both down. There were about maybe 24 beginning recovering addicts there in the anechoic vestry of an upscale church in what Erdetti figured had to be either West Belmont or East Waltham. The chairs were arranged in N.A.'s traditional huge circle, with no tables to sit at, and everybody balancing ashtrays on their knees and accidentally kicking over their cups of coffee. Everybody who raised their hand to share concurred on the insidious ways marijuana had ravaged their bodies, minds, and spirits. "Marijuana destroys slowly but thoroughly," was the consensus. Ken Erdetti's joggling foot knocked over his coffee not once but twice as the N.A.'s took turns concurring on the hideous psychic fallout they'd all endured both in active marijuana dependency and then in marijuana detox. The social isolation, anxious lassitude, and the hyper-self-consciousness that then reinforced the withdrawal and anxiety. The increasing emotional abstraction, poverty of affect, and then total emotional catalepsy. The obsessive analyzing. Finally, the paralytic stasis that results from the obsessive analysis of all possible implications of both getting up from the couch and not getting up from the couch. And then, the endless, symptomatic gauntlet of withdrawal from Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, i.e., pot detox. The loss of appetite, the mania and insomnia, the chronic fatigue and nightmares, the impotence and cessation of menses and lactation, the circadian arrhythmia, the sudden sauna-type sweats and mental confusion and fine motor tremors, the particularly nasty excess production of saliva, several beginners still holding institutional drool cups just under their chins, the generalized anxiety and foreboding and dread, and the shame of feeling like neither MDs nor the hard drug NAs themselves showed much empathy or compassion for the addict brought down by what was supposed to be nature's humblest buzz, the benignest substance around. Ken Erdetti noticed that nobody came right out and used the terms melancholy or anhedonia or depression, much less clinical depression. But this worst of symptoms, this logarithm of all suffering, seemed, though unmentioned, to hang fog-like, just over the room's heads, to drift between the peristyle columns and over the decorative astrolabes and candles on long prickets and medieval knockoffs and framed Knights of Columbus charters, a gassy plasm so dreaded no beginner could bear to look up and name it. Kate Gompert kept staring at the floor and making a revolver of her forefinger and thumb and shooting herself in the temple, and then blowing pretend cordite off the barrel's tip until Johnette Fultz whispered to her to knock it off. As was his custom at meetings, Ken Erdetti said nothing and observed everybody else very closely, cracking his knuckles and joggling his foot. Since an N.A. beginner is technically anybody with under a year clean, there were varying degrees of denial and distress and general cluelessness in this plush, upscale vestry. The meeting had the usual broad demographic cross-section, but the bulk of these grass-ravaged people looked to him urban and tough and busted up and dressed without any color sense at all. People you could easily imagine smacking their kid in a supermarket or lurking with a homemade sap in the dark of a downtown alley. Same as AA. Motley disrespectability was like the room norm, along with glazed eyes and excess spittle. A couple of the beginners still had the milky plastic ID bracelets from the psych wards they'd forgotten to cut off, or else hadn't yet gotten up the drive to do it. Unlike Boston AA, Boston NA has no mid-meeting raffle break and goes for just an hour. At the close of this Monday beginners meeting, everybody got up and held hands in a circle and recited the NA conference approved, "Just for Today." Then they all recited the Our Father, not exactly in unison. Kate Gompert later swore she distinctly heard the tattered older man beside her say, "And lead us not into Penn Station. during the Our Father. Then, just as in AA, the NA meeting closed with everybody shouting to the air in front of them to keep coming back because it works. But then, kind of horrifically, everyone in the room started milling around wildly and hugging each other. It was like somebody'd thrown a switch. There wasn't even very much conversation. It was just hugging, as far as her daddy could see. Rampant, indiscriminate hugging, where the point seemed to be to hug as many people as possible, regardless of whether you'd ever seen them before in your life. People went from person to person, arms out and leaning in. Big people stooped and short people got up on tiptoe. Jowls ground into other jowls. Both genders hugged both genders. And the male-to-male hugs were straight embraces, hugs minus the vigorous little thumps on the back that her daddy'd always seen as somehow requisite for male-to-male hugs. Jeanette Foltz was almost a blur. She went from person to person. She was racking up serious numbers of hugs. Kate Gompert had her usual lipless expression of morose distaste, but even she gave and got some hugs. But her daddy, who never particularly liked hugging, moved way back from the throng, over up next to the NA conference-approved literature table, and stood there by himself with his hands in his pockets, pretending to study the coffee urn with great interest. But then a tall, heavy Afro-American fellow with a gold incisor and perfect vertical cylinder of Afro-American hairstyle peeled away from a sort of group hug nearby. He'd spotted her daddy, and the fellow came over and established himself right in front of her daddy, spreading the arms of his fatigue jacket for a hug, stooping slightly and leaning in toward her daddy's personal trunk region. Her daddy raised his hands in a benign, "No thanks," and backed up further so that his bottom was squashed up against the edge of the conference-approved literature table.
Thanks, but I don't, particularly like to hug," he said.
The fellow had to sort of pull up out of his pre-hug lean, and stood there awkwardly frozen, his big arms still out, which her daddy could see must have been awkward and embarrassing for the fellow. Her daddy found himself trying to calculate just what remote sub-Asian locale would be the maximum possible number of kilometers away from this exact spot and moment as the fellow just stood there, his arms out and the smile draining from his face.
"Say what?"
the fellow said. Her daddy proffered a hand.
"Ken E., Ennett House, Enfield, how do you do? You are..."
The fellow slowly let his arms down, but just looked at her daddy's proffered hand. A single, styptic blink.
"Roy, Tony," he said.
"Roy, how do you do?"
"What it is," Roy said.
The big fellow now had his handshake hand behind his neck and was pretending to feel the back of his neck, which her daddy didn't know was a blatant diss.
"Well, Roy, if I may call you Roy, Mr. Tony, if you prefer, unless it's a compound first name, hyphenated, Roy, Tony, and then a last name. But, well, with respect to this hugging thing, Roy, it's nothing personal, rest assured."
"Assured?"
Her daddy's best helpless smile, and an apologetic shrug of the Gore-Tex anorak.
"I'm afraid I just don't particularly like to hug. Just not a hugger. Never have been. It was something of a joke among my family."
Now the ominous finger-pointing of street aggression. This Roy fellow pointing first at her daddy's chest, and then at his own.
"So, man, what you say, you saying I'm a hugger? You saying you think I go around like the hug?"
Both her daddy's hands were now up, palms out, and waggling in that bonhomic gesture of heading off all possible misunderstanding.
"No, but see, the whole point is that I wouldn't presume to call you either a hugger or a non-hugger because I don't know you. I only meant to say it's nothing personal having to do with you as an individual. And I'd be more than happy to shake hands, even one of those intricate, multiple-handed ethnic handshakes, if you'll bear with my inexperience with that sort of handshake. But I'm simply uncomfortable with the whole idea of
hugging. By the time Jeanette Fultz could break away and get over to them, the fellow had Erdetti by his anorak's insulated lapels and was leaning him way back over the edge of the literature table so that Erdetti's waterproof lodge boots were off the ground. And the fellow's face was right up in Erdetti's face in a show of naked aggression.
"You think I fucking like to go around hug on folks? You think any of us like this shit? We fucking do what they tell us. They tell us hugs, not drugs in here. We done motherfucking surrendered our wills in here," Roy said. "You little faggot," Roy added.
He wedged his hand between them to point at himself, which meant he was now holding Erdetti off the ground with just one hand, which fact was not lost on Erdetti's nervous system.
"I done had to give four hugs my first night here, and then I gone ran in the fucking can and fucking puked. Puked," he said. "Not comfortable? Who the fuck are you? Don't even try and tell me I'm coming over here feeling comfortable about trying to hug on your James River Traders wearing Calvin Klein aftershave smelling goofy ass motherfucking ass."
Erdetti observed one of the Afro-American women who was looking on clap her hands and shout,
"Talk about it!
And now you go and disrespect me in front of my whole clean and sober set just when I gone risk sharing my vulnerability and discomfort with you?"
Jeanette Fultz was sort of pawing at the back of Roy Tony's fatigue jacket, shuddering mentally at how the report of an in-house resident assaulted at an N.A. meeting she'd personally brought him to would look written up in the staff log.
"Now," Roy said,
extracting his free hand and pointing to the vestry floor with a stabbing gesture.
"Now," he said, "you gonna risk vulnerability and discomfort and hug my ass? Or do I gonna fucking rip your head off and shit down your neck?"
Jeanette Fultz had hold of the Roy fellow's coat now with both hands and was trying to pull the fellow off, Keds scrabbling for purchase on the smooth parquet, saying,
"Yo, Roy T, man, easy there, dude, man. Essie, bro, posse, crew, Holmes, Jim, brother, he's just new is all."
But by this time, Erdetti had both arms around the guy's neck and was hugging him with such vigor, Kate Gompert later told Joelle Van Dyne it looked like Erdetti was trying to climb him.
"We've lost a couple already," Steepley admitted. "During the testing? Not just volunteers. Some idiot intern in data analysis yielded to temptation and wanted to see what all the fuss was for and got hold of Flatto's IO Labs clearance card and went in and viewed.
From among the many read-only copies of your stock of the entertainment?"
"No great tragic loss in itself," lose some idiot child intern, Sailor Gare. "The real loss was that his supervisor tried to go in after him and pull him out. Our head of data analysis himself.
Hein, Henri, or pronounce Henry, middle initial of F, with the wife, with his adult diabetes he controls."
"Did control. 20-year man, Hank. Damn good man. He was a friend. He's in 4-point restraints now. Nourishment through a tube. No desire or even basic survival-type will for anything other than more viewing.
Of eat."
"I tried to visit."
"With your sleeveless skirt and different breasts?"
"I couldn't even stand to be in the same room. See him like that. Begging for just even a few seconds, a trailer, a snatch of soundtrack, anything. His eyes wobbling around like some drug-addicted newborn. Break your fucking heart."
In the next bed, restrained, the idiot intern. This was the sort of undisciplined, selfish child you like to talk about, Raimi. But Hank Hoyne was no child. I watched this man put down all sugar and treats when he first got diagnosed. Just put him down and walked away, not even a whimper or backward glance.
"A wheel of steel?"
"An American adult of exemplary self-control and discretion."
"The sum is that is not to be played crazily about with, so. We too have lost persons. It is serious."
The legs of the constellation of Perseus were amputated by the Earth's horizon. Perseus, he wore the hat of a jongleur, or pantalone. Hercules' head, this head was square. It was not long to dawn, also because At 32 degrees north, Pollux and Castor became visible. They were over Marat's left shoulder, as if giants were looking over his shoulder, one of Castor's legs, inbent, in a feminine manner.
"But do you ever consider?"
Steeply lit another cigarette.
"Fantasize, you are meaning."
"If it's that consuming, if it somehow addresses desires that total," Steeply said.
"Not even sure I can imagine what desires that total and utter even are." Up and down upon the toes, turning above the waist only to look back at Marat.
"You ever think of what it'd be like? Speculate?"
"As we think of what ends the entertainment may serve, we find its efficacy tempting.
You, and we, are tempted in different ways." Marat could identify no other Southwest USA constellations except the Big Dipper, which at this latitude appeared attached to the Great Bear to form something resembling the Great Bucket or the Great Cradle. The chair gave small squeaks when he shifted his weight upon it. Steeply said,
"Well, I can't say I've been tempted in the strictest sense of tempted."
"Perhaps we are meaning different things, Bezies?"
"Frankly, when I think of it, I'm as much terrified as I am intrigued. Hank Voyne is an empty shell. The iron will, the analytic savvy, his love of a fine cigar, all gone. His world's as if it has collapsed into one small bright point, inner world, lost to us. Look in his eyes and there's nothing you can recognize in them."
"Poor Miriam." Steeply needed a bare shoulder.
"Willis, on the IO night shift, came up with a phrase for their eyes. Empty of intent." This appeared in a memo.
Marat pretended to sniff.
"The temptation of the passive reward of Terminal P, the soul seems complex to me. Terror seems part of the temptation for you. Us of Quebec's cause, we have never felt this temptation for the entertainment, or knowing. But we respect its power. Thus we do not fool crazily about."
It was not that the sky was lightening so much as that the stars' light had paled. There became a sullenness about their light. Now, also, strange-looking USA insects whirred actively past from time to time, moving jaggedly and making Marat think of many wind-blown sparks. The 10th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The following things in the room were blue. The blue checks and the blue and black checked shag carpet. Two of the room's six institutional plush chairs, whose legs were steel tubes bent into big ellipses which wobbled, so that while the chairs couldn't really be rocked in, they could be sort of bobbed in, which Michael Pemulis was doing absently as he waited and scanned a printout of Eschaton's highly technical core Escacs directory, i.e., bobbing in his chair, which produced a kind of rapid rodential squeaking that gave Hallen Candenza a howling fantods as he sat there kitty-corner from Pemulis, also waiting. The printout kept rotating in Pemulis's hands. Each chair had a 105-watt reading lamp attached to the back on a flexible metal stalk that let the reading lamp curve out from behind and shine right down on whatever magazine the waiting person was looking at. But since the curved lamps induced this unbearable sensation of somebody feverish right there reading over your shoulder, the magazines, some of whose covers involved the color blue, tended to stay unread, and were fanned neatly out on a low ceramic coffee table. The carpet was a product of something called Antron. Hal could see streaks of lividity where somebody'd vacuumed against the grain. Though the magazine's coffee table was non-blue, a wet nail polish red with ETA in a kind of gray escutcheon, two of the unsettlingly attached lamps that kept its magazines unread and neatly fanned were blue, although the two blue lamps were not the lamps attached to the two blue chairs. Dr. Charles Tavis liked to say that you could tell a lot about an administrator by the decor of his waiting room. The headmaster's waiting room was part of a little hallway in the ComEd lobby's southwest corner. The preemie violets, in an asymmetrical sprig, in a tennis ball-shaped vase, on the coffee table were, arguably, in the blue family. And also the over-enhanced blue of the wallpaper sky, which the wallpaper scheme was fluffy cumuli, arrayed, patternlessly, against an over-enhancedly blue sky. Incredibly disorienting wallpaper that was, by an unpleasant coincidence, also the wallpaper in the Enfield offices of a Dr. Zigarelli, DDS, which Hal's just come back from, after a removal. The left side of his face still feels big and dead, with this persistent sensation that he's drooling without being able to feel it or stop it. No one's sure what CT's choice of this wallpaper is supposed to communicate, especially to parents who come with prospective kids in tow to scout out ETA. But Hal loathes the sky and cloud wallpaper because it makes him feel high altitude and disoriented and sometimes plummeting. The sills and crosspieces of the waiting room's two windows have always been dark blue. There was a nautical blue border of braid around the bill of Michael Pemulis's jaunty yachting cap. Hal was confident Pemulis would remove the insouciant hat the minute they were called in on what was presumably going to be the carpet. Also blue? The upper border slices of sky in the framed informal photos of ETA students that hung on the walls.
209.
The chassis of Alice Moore's Intel 972 word processor with modem, but no cartridge capability. Also, Ms. Moore's fingertips and lips. The ETA headmaster's receptionist and administrative assistant is known to the players as Lateral Alice Moore. In her youth, Lateral Alice Moore had been a helicopter pilot and airborne traffic reporter for a major Boston radio station, until a tragic collision with another station's airborne traffic report helicopter, plus then the cataclysmic fall to the rush hour's Jamaica Way six-laner below, had left her with chronic oxygen debt and a neurological condition whereby she was able to move only from side to side. So, hence the sobriquet Lateral Alice Moore. An effective time killer while sitting there waiting for whatever administrators summoned you is to have Lateral Alice Moore drum rapidly on her chest and give imitations of her old Boston rush hour traffic reports in a stuttered, helicopterish reporter voice. Neither Hal, continually checking his chin for drool, nor Pemulis, scanning and bobbing, nor Ann Kittenplan, nor Trevor Axford, about whom there was today not even a hint of the color blue, are in the mood for this right now, awaiting what they presume to be some kind of administrative fallout from Sunday's horrendous eschaton fiasco. The presumption is based on who's been summoned here to wait. The two different size offices that open off the waiting room, through the open and only other door of which the dusky blue Mannington shag of the ComEd lobby is visible, belong to Dr. Charles Tavis and to Mrs. Averill Incandenza. Tavis's office's outer door is real oak and has his name and degree and title in non-blue letters so big that the total ID crowns the door's margins. There's also an inner door. Averill, whose feelings about enclosure are well known, has no door on her office. Her office is bigger than CT's, though, and has a seminar table it's always been obvious he covets. Averill's office's blue and black checkered shag is deeper than the waiting room's shag, so that the border between the two is like a mowed versus unmowed lawn. Averill serves pro bono as ETA's Dean of Academic Affairs and Dean of Females. She's in there, unenclosed, right now, with pretty much every ETA female under 13 except Ann Kittenplan, whose tattooed knuckles are bruised and who looks somehow cross-dressed in a dress and non-blue beret. Averill has vividly white hair, as of the last few months before himself, fellow to say, that looks like it never went through the gray stage. It mostly didn't. And legs, whose taper you can see T. Axford is appraising with the frankness of adolescence, as she paces a bit in front of the crowded seminar table, in full, if kind of oblique angled view of the people in the waiting room.
210.
Though it's not technically in the waiting room with Hal, the plastic, fine-tip, felt pen Avril taps professionally against her incisors as she paces and considers is blue. Administrative diddle checks have been required at all North American tennis academies since the infamous case of Coach R. Bill Touchy Feely at California's Rolling Hills Academy, whose hair-raising diary and collection of telephotos and tiny panties, discovered only after his disappearance into the Humboldt County hill country with a 13-year-old companion, created what might be conservatively termed a climate of concern among the continent's tennis parents. At the Enfield Tennis Academy for the last 4 years, Dr. Dolores Rusk is supposed to hold a kind of distaff community meeting with all female players judged naive and moppetish enough to be potential diddlees. The youngest of these is Rhode Island's pint-sized Tina Echt, just 7, but a true cannibal off the backhand side, to interface in a discreet but nurturingly empowering group setting, etc., and nip any potential feelyisms in the bud. Monthly diddle checks are in Rusk's contract because they are in ETA's ONANTA accreditation charter. Dean of Females, Avril M. Condenza, presides over the diddle check when Dr. Rusk is otherwise engaged, and Rusk is so very rarely legitimately engaged that the fact that it's the moms doing diddle prevention duty today leads Hal to fear that Rusk is maybe in there in the headmaster's office, getting ready to be in on the upcoming disciplinary scene. CT would have to be really upset to want to have Rusk included. Rusk might be there more for CT than for any studential psyches. Axendel has his eyes closed and is repeating a mnemonic limerick about Brewster's angle for the Leith-taught quadrivial colloquium Reflections on Refraction. Michael Pemulis is still scanning a serrated scroll of End Stataxiomatic Pink Sub 2, which looks to be all math and spiky brackets, and bobbing and ignoring Ann Kittenplan's murderous looks and tubercular throat clearings at the squeaking of his bobbing blue chair. You can tell Pemulis really is studying because he keeps turning something upside down and then right side up. Hal declines to share his Rusk being in there with Tavis worries with Michael Pemulis. Not just because Hal avoids ever mentioning Rusk's name, but also because Pemulis loathes Rusk with a hard and gem-like flame, and though he'd never admit it, is already clearly nauseated with worry that he's going to get the lion's share of the blame for damage to Lord and Postlethwaite, and not only receive corrective on-court discipline, but maybe get denied a spot on the trip to Tucson's Whataburger, or worse.
211.
Avril is indirect but syntactically crisp with the couple dozen little girls in there, probing. The girls' outfits involve blue at many levels of hue and intensity and varied combination. Avril Incandenza's voice is higher on the register than one would expect from a woman so imposingly tall. It is high and sort of airy. Oddly insubstantial is the ETA consensus. Oren says one reason Avril dislikes music is that whenever she hums along, she sounds insane. The absence of a door to the mom's office means you might as well be in there, in terms of being able to hear what's going on. She has little sense of spatial privacy or boundary, having been so much alone so much when a child. Lateral Alice Moore wears a sort of surreal combination of black lycra spandex and filmy green tulle. The portable stereo headphones she wears, entering what appear to be response macros for 80-plus received invitations to next week's Whataburger Invitational, are powder blue. Her typing is clearly in sync with something's backbeat. Her lips and cheek points are the vague robin's egg of cyanosis. Just why Michael Pemulis hates Dr. Rusk is unclear and seems free-floating. Hal gets a different answer from Pemulis every time. Hal himself feels uncomfortable around Dolores Rusk and avoids her, but isn't aware of any particular reason for being uncomfortable around her. But Pemulis positively detests Rusk. It was Pemulis who'd dickied in at night and hooked a Delco battery up to the inside brass knob of her locked office door at age 15, Rusk's office door. The first door over in the other little hallway at the lobby's northeast corner, next to the shift nurse's office and infirmary, then exiting Rusk's office by a window in Thorny Hedge, which Pemulis was extremely fortunate no one but Hal and Shocked, and maybe Mario, knew he authored the hot knob, because the whole scheme turned quickly disastrous. Because it was an elderly, Brighton, Irish cleaning lady who got to the hot knob first at like 0500 hours. And it turned out Pemulis had seriously undercalculated the brass conducted Delco voltage involved. And if the cleaning lady hadn't been wearing yellow rubber cleaning lady gloves, she would have ended up with way worse than the permanent perm and irreversible crossed eyes she regained consciousness with. And the cleaning lady's ward boss was Upper Brighton's infamous FX Follow That Ambulance Burn, rapacious personal injury JD. And the Academy's workman's comp premiums had skyrocketed, and the whole thing was still in litigation. Avril had eschewed an office door even before the cleaning lady Kertwang for simple enclosure reasons. Recrossed legs and closer inspection reveal that Trevor Axford's left sock, though not his right sock, is blue. Sinistral, his right hand missing digits from a fireworks accident 3 Interdependence Days past, axe handle is several centimeters shorter than Helen Condenza, and is a true red-headed person. With copper-colored hair and that moist, white, freckle-chalked skin that even through 2 layers of summer pledge only reddens and peels, plus there's the matter of the enormous and forever chapped lips. And as a tennis player, he is like a less effective version of John Wayne. He does nothing but blast from the baseline without discernible spin. He's a junior from Short Beach, Connecticut, and under enormous family pressure to continue the male Axford tradition of getting Yale, and is academically so marginal that he knows his only chance to go to Yale is to play tennis for Yale, which would effectively blow any chance at a show-level future, and is high-ranked but has set his competitive sights on nothing past a ride offer to Yale. Though Ingersoll's informally in Hal's big buddy contingent, he's technically in axe handles, they're both aware. And Hal's a little uncomfortable about his relief that none of the real eschaton casualties were technically his buddies.
212.
The only real thing Axford and Hal have in common on the court is a curious habit of refusing to ask for help from other courts when their balls go astray.
213.
Pemulis has finally quit with the bobbing and folded the printout scroll of pink sub-2 into a big, ragged square and has sidled over to lateral Alice Moore's horseshoe-shaped desk and is bantering with her very casually, looking all around him as he banters, trying subtly to feel her out, regarding whether maybe one of these Whataburger Junior Invitational invitations stacked cruciform, female athwart male, in lateral Alice's inbox, concerns anybody with the male initials MMP by any chance. Pemulis and Moore would be less tight if she knew he dickied in at night and used her watts and modem, though she's very laid back and easygoing, and not at all like the little framed thing by her name plaque with a scowling woman saying, "I've got one nerve left and you're getting on it." The little cartoon is just a standard, like, office worker gag. She'd summoned them out of sixth hour with the same ancient intercom and mic system Trolch and others get to commandeer for Saturday's WETA. Trolch has had to be prohibited from playing with her chair. And her transmitted voice had not been ungentle. Hal's face's left side feels queerly inflated. But then when he runs his right hand over it, it's always regulation size. Administrative assistants worth their health benefits are synaptically evolved to the point where they can banter, accept compliments on a spandex and tulle ensemble, effortlessly deflect unauthorized info probes, listen to something bass intensive on personal stereo headphones, and word process effortlessly to the headphones' backbeat, all simultaneously. Lateral Alice Moore's bluish fingertips make her painted nails 10 little sunsets. Lateral Alice Moore's desk's chair's wheels fit on a track with an electrified third rail so she can slide from one corner of the horseshoe's arc to the other, more or less laterally, at the touch of a Cerise desktop button. For post-Delco incident legal reasons, the name plaque on her reception desk has Danger, Third Rail, instead of the name Lateral Alice Moore. Hal can hear Avril saying,
"Now, if I speak to all of you very gently about being touched by a tall person in an uncomfortable way, will you know what I mean? Have any of you been kissed, or nuzzled, or hugged, or rubbed, or pinched, or probed, or fondled, or in any way touched by a tall person in a way that's made you uncomfortable?"
Hal can see one of his mom's stockinged legs, terminating in a trim ankle and a very white Reebok, extruding from stage right into the frame of the empty doorway. The Reebok, tapping patiently, and one arm crossed over Avril's chest, and the other arm's elbow resting on that arm and fluttering in and out of view as Avril taps at her teeth with a blue pen.
"Grandma pinches my cheek,"
one girl volunteers. She'd actually raised her hand to be called on. Her wrist, with its touching little blue terry wristband. Hal hasn't seen so many pigtails and button noses and small berry-shaped mouths convened in one indoor place in who knows how long. Very few of the sneakered feet reach all the way to the thick shag in there. Much leg dangling and absent, uncomfortable sneaker swinging. A couple fingers in nostrils and absent contemplation. Anne Kittenplan in her blue chair is coolly appraising the little wash-offable tattoos she applies daily to the knuckles of her hands.
"Not quite what we're trying to speak of together right now, Erica."
From someplace above the tapping foot and in-and-out arm. Hal knows the register and inflections of his mother's voice so well, it almost makes him uncomfortable. His left ankle gives a sick squeak when he flexes it. Cords in his left forearm stand out and subside as he squeezes his tennis ball. The left side of his face feels like something far away that means him harm and is coming gradually closer. He can make out just the whistly fricatives of Charles Tavis's distant voice from behind his double office doors. It sounds somehow like he's speaking to more than one person in there. Charles Tavis's office's inner door also has the ID, Dr. Charles Tavis, on it, and below that his ETA motto about the man who knows his limitations having none.
"She does it really hard,"
rebuts what must be Erica Cerise.
"I've seen her do it,"
what sounds like Jolene Kreese confirms. And another,
"I hate that. I hate it when some adult pats my head like I'm a schnauzer. The next adult that calls me adorable is in for a really unpleasant surprise, let me tell you. I hate it when my hair is tousled or smoothed in any way. Kittenplan's tall. Kittenplan gives Indian rub burns after lights out."
Avril gives them verbal space, tries gently to steer the topic closer to true filialism. She's subtle and very good with small children.
"That my daddy gives me these small little shoves in the small of the back when he wants me to go into rooms. It's like he influences me into rooms from behind. This tiny little irritating push that makes me want to let him have it in the shin." "Mm-hmm,"
Avril muses. It's impossible not to overhear, because things out in the waiting room right now are so comparatively silent except for the tiny hiss of lateral Alice Moore's disengaged headphones and the conspiratorial murmur of Michael Pemulis trying to get her to drum on her chest and describe I-93 South's Neponset exit ramp as one very long, thin parking lot. Things are so quiet because the anxiety level in Tavis's waiting room is high.
"You're all in for some serious pukers, is my prediction,"
Ann Kittenplan had said to Pemulis, as they all first answered the intercom summons, which was also about the time that Pemulis started in with the rodential chair squeaking that made one half of Kittenplan's face spasm. One of the tricky and sinister things about corrective discipline at a tennis academy is that punishments can take the form of what might look like straight-out athletic conditioning. Quod vide, the drill sergeant telling the recruit to drop and give him 50, etc. But this is why Gerhard Schtitt and his pro-rectors are way more feared than Ogilvy or Richardson, Levy, O'Brien, Chawaff, or any of the regular academics. It's not just that Schtitt's corporal reputation preceded him here. It's that Schtitt and DeLint make out the daily schedules for AM drills and PM matches and resistance training and conditioning runs, but especially the AM drills. Certain drills are well known to be nothing more than attitude adjusters designed to do nothing but dramatically lower life quality for a few minutes. Too brutal to be assigned on the daily basis that would contribute to genuine aerobic conditioning, drills like the disciplinary version of tap and whack are known to the kids simply as pukers.
214.
Puker drills are really meant to do nothing but hurt you and make you think long and hard before repeating whatever you did to merit them. But they're still, to all outward appearances, exempt from any kind of Eighth Amendment protest or sniveling calls home to parents, insidiously, since they can be described to parents and police alike as just drills, assigned for your overall cardiovascular benefit, with all the actual sadism completely sub rosa.
215.
Kittenplan's prediction that the upperclassmen are going to wear the whole brown helmet for the eschaton free-for-all is hopefully rebuttable by Pemulis's observation that eschaton's extracurricular impulse and structure had been firmly in place before any of them even enrolled. All Michael Pemulis had done was codify basic principles and impose a sort of matrix of decidable strategy. Maybe helped create a mythology and established, mostly through personal example, a certain level of expectation. All Howell'd done was act as amanuensis on a lousy manual. The Interdependence Day combatants had been out there of their own volition. Pemulis and Axford had gotten Hal to write out most of all this in a maximally rhetorical diction, which Pemulis had then embedded in a pink sub-2 printout so he could carry it around and study it and have it all nailed down before Tavis tried any boom lowering. The strategy is to let Pemulis do all the talking, but let Hal interject at will, the voice of reason. Good cop, bad. Axford's been instructed to count the antron fibers between his shoes the whole time they're in there. Hal has no idea what it might signify that the headmaster's summons hasn't come for almost 48 hours. It might be odd that it hadn't once occurred to him to see Tavis personally, or to go to the headmaster's house and ask the moms for intercession or info. It's not like he had the urge but resisted it. It hadn't even occurred to him. For somebody who not only lives on the same institutional grounds as his family, but also has his training and education and pretty much his whole overall raison d'etre directly overseen by relatives, Hal devotes an unusually small part of his brain and time ever thinking about people in his family qua family members. Sometimes when he'll be chatting with somebody in the endless registration line for a tournament, or at a post-meet dance or something, and somebody'll say something like, "How's Avril getting along?" Or, "I saw Oren kicking the ever-living shit out of the ball on an ONANFL highlights cartridge last week." There will be this odd tense moment where Hal's mind will go utterly blank and his mouth slack and flabby, working soundlessly, as if the names were words on the tip of his tongue. Except for Mario, about whom Hal will talk your ear off, it's almost like some ponderous creaky machine has to get up and running for Hal even to think about members of his immediate family as standing in relation to himself. It's a possible reason Hal avoids Dr. Dolores Rusk, who always wants to probe him on issues of space and self-definition, and something she keeps calling the Coatlicue complex.
216.
Hal's maternal half-uncle, Charles Tavis, is a little like the late himself in that Tavis's CV is a back-and-forth, but not indecisive mix, of athletics and hard science. ABA and doctorate in engineering. An MBA in athletics administration. In his professional youth, Tavis had put them together as a civil engineer. His specialty, the accommodation of stress through patterned dispersal, i.e., distributing the weight of gargantuan athletic spectatorial crowds, i.e., he'd say, he'd handled large live audiences. He'd been, in his own small way, a minor pioneer in polymer-reinforced cement and mobile fulcra. He'd been on design teams for stadia and civic centers and grandstands and micrological-looking superdomes. He'd admit up front that he'd been a far better team player engineer than out there up front stage center in the architectural limelight. He'd apologize profusely when you had no idea what that sentence meant, and say maybe the obfuscation had been unconsciously deliberate, out of some kind of embarrassment over his first and last limelighted architectural supervision up in Ontario, before the rise of ON-ANite interdependence, when he designed the Toronto Blue Jays novel and much ballyhooed Skydome ballpark and hotel complex. Because Tavis had been the one to take the lion's share of the heat when it turned out that Blue Jays spectators in the stands, many of them innocent children wearing caps and pounding their little fists into the gloves they'd brought with hopes of nothing more exotic than a speared foul ball, that spectators at a distressing number of different points all along both foul lines could see right into the windows of guests having various and sometimes exotic sex in the hotel bedrooms over the center field wall. The bulk of the call for Tavis's rolling head had come, he'd tell you, when the cameraman in charge of the Skydome's instant replay video scoreboard, disgruntled or professionally suicidal or both, started training his camera on the bedroom windows and routing the resultant multi-limbed coital images up onto the 75-meter scoreboard screen, etc., sometimes in slow motion, and with multiple replays, etc. Tavis will admit his reluctance to talk about it still after all this time. He'll confess that his usual former career summary is to say just that he'd specialized in athletic venues that could safely and comfortably seat enormous numbers of live spectators, and that the market for his services had bottomed out as more and more events were designed for cartridge dissemination and private home viewing, which, he'll point out, is not technically untrue so much as just not entirely open and forthcoming. Lateral Alice Moore is printing out Whataburger RSVPs. The Intel 972 is cutting edge, but she clings to a hideous, old, dot matrix printer she refuses to replace, as long as Dave Hardy can keep it going. It's the same with the intercom system and its antiquated iron stand-up mic that Trolch says is an affront to the whole broadcasting profession. Lateral Alice has queer, eccentric pockets of intransigence and Ludditism, due possibly to her helicopter crash and neurologic deficits. The printer's needly sound fills the waiting room. Hal finds he can be confident of his face's symmetry and saliva only when he sits there with his right hand over his left cheek. Each line of Alice's printed response sounds like some sort of supposedly unrippable fabric getting ripped over and over. A dental and life-denying sound. For Hal, the general deal with his maternal uncle is that Tavis is terribly shy around people and tries to hide it by being very open and expansive and wordy and bluff. and that it's excruciating to be around. Mario's way of looking at it is that Tavis is very open and expansive and wordy, but so clearly uses these qualities as a kind of protective shield that it betrays a frightened vulnerability, almost impossible not to feel for. Either way, the unsettling thing about Charles Tavis is that he's possibly the openest man of all time. Oren, in Marlon Bane's view, was always that C.T. was less like a person than like a sort of cross-section of a person. Even the moms, Hal could remember, relating anecdotes about how as a teenager, when she'd taken the child C.T. or been around him at Quebecois functions or gatherings involving other kids, the child C.T. had been too self-conscious and awkward to join right in with any group of the kids clustered around, talking or plotting or whatever. And so Avril said she'd watched him just kind of drift from cluster to cluster and lurk around creepily on the fringe, listening, but that he'd always say, loudly, in some lull in the group's conversation, something like, "I'm afraid I'm far too self-conscious really to join in here, so I'm just going to lurk creepily at the fringe and listen, if that's all right, just so you know." And so on. But, so, the point is that Tavis is an odd and delicate specimen, both ineffectual and in certain ways fearsome as a headmaster, and being a relative guarantees no special predictive insight or quarter, unless certain maternal connections are exploited, the thought of doing which literally does not occur to Hal. This odd blankness about his family might be one way to manage a life where domestic and vocational authorities sort of bleed into each other. Hal squeezes his tennis ball like a madman, sitting there in the needly printout noise, right palm against his left cheek, an elbow hiding his mouth, wanting very much to go first to the pump room, and then to brush vigorously with his portable collapsible Oral-B. A quick chew of Kodiak is out of the question for several reasons. The only other time this year that Hal was officially summoned to the headmaster's waiting room had been in late August, right before convocation and during orientation period, when YDAU's new kids were coming in and wandering around clueless and terrified, etc., and Tavis had wanted Hal to take temporary charge of a 9-year-old kid coming in from somewhere called Philo, Illinois, who was allegedly blind, the kid, and apparently had cranium issues. From having originally been one of the infantile natives of Ticonderoga, New York, evacuated too late, and had several eyes in various stages of evolutionary development in his head, but was legally blind, but still an extremely solid player, which is all kind of a long tale in itself, given that his skull was apparently the consistency of a Chesapeake crab shell. But the head itself was so huge, it made Boo-Boo look microcephalic, and the kid apparently had on-court use of only one hand, because the other had to pull around beside him a kind of rolling IV stand appliance with a halo-shaped metal brace welded to it at head height to encircle and support his head. But anyway, Tex Watson and Thorpe had broken C.T. down over the kid's admission and tuition waiver. And C.T. now figured the kid would need, to say the least, some extra help getting oriented, literally, and he wanted Hal to be the one to take him in hand, again, literally. It turned out a couple days later that the kid had some kind of either family or cerebrospinal fluid crisis at home in rural Illinois, and wasn't matriculating now till the spring term. But back in August, Hal had sat in the very chair Trevor Axford is now nodding off in, very late in the day, like dusk, having had an informal exhibition match with a visiting Latvian satellite pro go an encouraging 3 sets. So that he'd missed Mrs. C's stuffed peppers at supper, his stomach making those "where's the food" noises from around the transverse colon, alone in the blue room, waiting and chair bobbing reflexively with lateral Alice Morgan home to her long apartment with rooms only 2 meters wide in Newton, and an opaque plastic dust thing wrapped tight over her Intel processor and intercom console, and the little red danger light on her danger third rail plaque unlit, and the only lights besides the weak dusk outside for the hot 105 watts of his chairback's creepy, blue-shaded magazine lamp, plus the multiple lamps on in Charles Tavis's office. Tavis has a phobic thing about overhead lighting. As Tavis was doing a late-day intake interview on impossibly tiny little Tina Echt, who just matriculated this fall at age 7. His doors were open because it was a brutal August, and D.V. Hardy had somehow rigged lateral Alice's air conditioner vent in the waiting room so it really put out. Tavis's office's outer door opened out, while the inner door opened in, which gave his little inter-door vestibule kind of a jaw-like quality when exposed. August YDAU had been when Hal's chronic left ankle had been almost the worst it's ever been, after an irrumpent but grueling summer tour of getting to at least the quarters of just about everything, mostly on hard asphalt.
217.
And he could feel his pulse in the vessels and the raw ligaments of the ankle as he sat flipping the shiny pages of a New World Tennis and watching the little ad cards fall out and flutter. But he also couldn't help exploiting the open-jawed view of a substantial section of Charles Tavis at his office desk, looking as usual, oddly foreshortened and small, and with his hands together on the massive desktop across from a partial profile view of a girl, who looked like she couldn't be much more than 5 or 6, preparing to receive intake papers as she listened to Tavis. There'd been no Echt parents or guardians anywhere in view. Some kids just get dropped off. Sometimes the parents' cars barely even stop, just slow down, throw gravel as they accelerate away. Tavis's desk drawers have squeaky casters. Jim Strzok's folks, Lincoln, hadn't even much slowed. Strzok had been helped to his feet and taken immediately to the locker room to shower the gravel out of his hair. Hal had been in charge of his orientation, too, when Strzok transferred, booted out of Palmer Academy after his pet tarantula, named Simone, another long story, escaped and wouldn't even have dreamed of biting the headmaster's wife if she hadn't screamed and passed out and fallen right on it, Strzok explained as Hal helped pick up suitcases tumbled all over the drive. Like many gifted bureaucrats, Hal's mother's adoptive brother Charles Tavis is physically small in a way that seems less endocrine than perspectival. His smallness resembles the smallness of something that's farther away from you than it wants to be, plus is receding.
218.
This weird appearance of recessive drift, together with the compulsive hand movements that followed his quitting smoking some years back, helped contribute to the quality of perpetual frenzy about the man, a kind of locational panic that it's easy to see explains not only Tavis's compulsive energy, he and Avril, pretty much the dynamic duo of compulsion between them, sleep in their second-floor rooms in the headmaster's house, separate rooms, tend to sleep, between them, about as much as any one normal insomniac, but maybe also contributes to the pathological openness of his manner, the way he thinks out loud about thinking out loud, a manner Ortho Stites can imitate so eerily, that he's been prohibited by the male 18s from doing his Tavis impression in front of the younger players, for fear that the littler kids will find it impossible to take the real Tavis seriously, at the times he needs to be taken seriously. As for the older kids, Stice can make them all double up now merely by shielding his eyes with his hand and assuming a horizontal scan expression whenever Tavis heaves into view, seeming to recede even as he bears down. C.T. as headmaster always has a number of introductory questions for matriculants. And Hal, now, in November, can't remember which one of these Tavis opened with Echt, but he remembers seeing the little girl's sucker stick sweep the air, and a plastic Mr. Bouncity Bounce, no pierce earring, swing wildly as she shook her head.
219.
Hal marveled at her size. How high could somebody this little be ranked, even regionally, in 12s? And then, yes, the sumptuous squeak of Tavis's big seagrass chair coming back forward as his elbows took his weight, and he laced his fingers together out across meters of polymer-reinforced shale desktop, custom-designed. The headmaster smiled as he leaned back, though hidden from Hal because of the shadow of the office's enormous stairblaster.
220.
Was nevertheless audible because of the thing with Charles Tavis's teeth, about which maybe the less said the better. Looking discreetly in, Hal had felt an involuntary rush of affection for C.T. His maternal uncle's hair was straight and very precisely combed over, and his little mustache was never quite symmetrical. One eye was also set at a slightly different angle than the other, so that besides holding his hand up to scan, Stice would also cock his head slightly to the side whenever C.T. came near. Hal's involuntary grin is lopsided and only half-felt now, remembering. The axe-handle sitting there, slumped with his fist to his chin, a posture that he thinks makes him look meditative, but that really makes him look in utero. And Kitten Plan is chewing at her knuckles tattoos, which is what she does, instead of washing them off. Then Ortho Stice had entered the hot waiting room, shirt wet and crew cut matted from the courts and toting his Wilsons, and made right for the AC vent's downdraft outside Tavis's little vestibule. Stice's clothes were comped by Fila, and when he played any sort of match, he wore all black, and at ETA, and on the tour, was known as the Darkness. He had a crew cut and the beginnings of jowls. He and Hal exchanged the very slight sorts of nods people use when they like each other past all need for politeness. They had similar games, although most of Stice's touch was at the net. Stice raised one hand to his eyes and cocked his head slightly in the direction of the office's lamplight. "The little guy gonna be a long time in there?" "You have to ask?" Tavis was saying, "What actually we do for you here is to break you down in very carefully selected ways, take you apart as a little girl and put you back together again as a tennis player who can take the court against any little girl in North America without fear of limitation, with a perspective unmarred by the eyelashes of whatever pockets you brought here. A little girl now who can regard the court as a mirror whose reflection holds no illusions or fear for you."
"Now the thing with the skull," Stice said.
Hal had watched goose flesh rise on Stice's arms and legs as he stood under the cold air and faced up and breathed, hugging his gear to his chest.